By Tuesday, April 1, normalcy was returning to most of the city. But for some, life would never be the same. The day was filled with funerals, including John W. Dickey, age 29, Edward Gallagher, age 18, John J. Goebel, age 18 or 19, Fritz Harmeyer, who had been a member of the St. Martin's Benevolence Society. In Middletown, Ohio, John Seeger's widow and small child were among a German Lutheran church full of mourners. As these men were going into the ground, the health office was issuing permits for more burials. Fred Eckelhorst, age 30, John Hennessy, 35, Edward Henze, 20, Andrew Slugger, 19, Andrew Grell, 19, Peter Roll, 25, J.N. Dickey, 30, Joseph Berald, 24, Henry Niemeyer, 43. The following day, two more would be laid to rest. Bernard Fink, a cobbler, who took a detour on his walk home to avoid getting caught up in the commotion when a guardsman bullet took his life. And Johnny Schmidt, the 14-year-old boy who cajoled his mother into letting him go see the courthouse fire. Many, many more would follow. Some of the funerals were large, some modest. All of them were life-altering events for the families, friends, and loved ones of the dead. But one funeral was treated very differently from all the rest. Only one of the dead went to the grave in a huge public spectacle. Sent to the afterlife as a martyr, dozens of National Guardmen representing different companies and regiments met at Captain John J. Desmond's former home to join a funeral procession that wound its way to St. Peter and Chain's Cathedral. Along the way, a military band played a funeral dirge. The melancholy music wafted into the rooms of the city hospital. Inside the hospital, dozens of men lay in extraordinary pain. Some were in the process of dying. While the men in the parade were being heralded as heroes, the ones in the hospital had been blanketly characterized by Governor Hoadley as the equivalent of, quote, a foreign foe. At St. Peter and Chain's, mourners packed into the huge Catholic cathedral. Then they filled the steps and street out front. It was a closed casket service, and maybe the closed casket was purely due to the nature of Desmond's wound, but some people speculated that there was another, darker reason. The Cincinnati Inquirer was an early adopter of the official version of Desmond's murder. The paper wrote, quote, "The lamentable shooting of Captain Desmond was at first attributed to the soldiers, but an investigation shows this to have been out of the question," unquote. The paper wrote that the investigation into Desmond's death proved unequivocally that he was murdered by a rioter. But what investigation they were talking about was unclear. There would be inquiries into Desmond's death, and as flawed as they would be, and they were flawed, none had even begun. And Coroner Musgrove wouldn't announce an official cause of death for 3.5 months. The nature of Desmond's head wound probably contained a wealth of information. Whether Desmond's wound was consistent with a pistol shot, a much larger caliber rifle round, or a Gatling gun round, could have answered a lot of questions. Even knowing whether he was shot in the front or the back of the head was important circumstantial evidence. This information was easily attainable, but people who claimed to have seen the body and the wound gave very different descriptions of it. A proper, standard medical examination could have put all of the mystery and speculation to rest. Instead, after a huge crowd filed past a closed casket, Captain John J. Desmond was laid to rest without an autopsy or any forensic examination. In 1891, long after the so-called inquiries into who murdered him, the Ohio legislature allocated $2,500 for a statue to the martyred John J. Desmond. But it was a matching grant, and the public needed to raise another $2,500 through private contributions. That took a lot longer than was originally expected, and multiple fundraisers were held until the funds were finally raised by 1899. In a way, the 8 years it took to come up with the money helped cement the legend of John J. Desmond. Every fundraising event was an opportunity to recount the official version of his death. And each time it was repeated, fewer people remembered that the heroic story of martyrdom was highly questionable. With every telling, every speech, every memorial, the story of the hero who was slain by rioters became more firmly ensconced as fact. When the completed life-size statue of Desmond was commemorated on May 6, 1899, the ceremony was packed with both people and irony. Now serving as adjutant general of the Ohio National Guard, former Sheriff Morton Hawkins was the grand marshal of the parade, and he was praised for his great organizational skills. The mayor declared it a holiday. Four police wagons led the parade, which was more than had initially responded to the growing lynch mob 15 years earlier. And the members of the 1st Regiment got into formation within sight of the new courthouse. When speeches began, Desmond was remembered for being murdered, quote, while heroically defending the courthouse from the attack of a desperate and frenzied mob, unquote. He was called a patriot and a martyr, and his death was in defense of law and order. The audience and reading public were told that the statue was also a reminder of the, quote, splendid service to Cincinnati, unquote, that the 1st Regiment had rendered in March 1884. The statue, originally located in Lincoln Park, became a tourist destination and a common gathering place for civic and National Guard events. A granite memorial to rewritten and whitewashed history. The following March, the Cincinnati Inquirer published one of the many retrospective pieces it would publish in the years ahead. It recalled how, quote, the ruffian who shot Desmond dead with a revolver bullet was himself killed during the following day. He lived long enough to confess the crime, unquote. This was based on a story that had been completely 100% debunked almost immediately after it was told and circulated in 1884. But it didn't really seem to matter anymore. Legend had long ago replaced any semblance of truth about what actually happened on March 28th through 30, 1884. It didn't have to be that way. An honest assessment of the mistakes that were made would have been valuable for America as a whole. It was not inevitable that the truth would become a casualty. It was a very concerted, intentional set of decisions that were made in the immediate wake of the tragedy. I'm Mike Morgan. a writer, attorney, historian, and a classically trained sommelier of gas station wine.
And I'm Amy Morgan. I'm also an attorney. I enjoy history, but I'm actually more of a true crime and politics junkie. And I'm helping tell this story because it involves all of these things.
And this is Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre. A true story about biased media, corruption, murder, a slaughter of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops, and the cover-up that followed. A cover-up which hid the truth so well that this is the first time it's being told.
In theory, there would be three separate inquiries into the events of March 28th through 30th, 1884. A Cincinnati Bar Association inquiry into ethical allegations against Tom C. Campbell, a Hamilton County Special Grand Jury investigation, and a coroner's inquest. This would all result in four criminal trials and a legal disbarment proceeding. Tom Campbell would be the defendant in three of these five proceedings, and in the end of it all, truth, justice, and any chance of learning from our mistakes would all become casualties in the process.
The full story, with all the legal ins and outs, is complicated. But we're going to break it all down to the basics in this episode to explain the massive, blatantly intentional whitewash that altered the accepted history of the March 1884 National Guard Massacre.
The first attempt to assess blame was a disbarment proceeding against Thomas C. Campbell. Then, as now, disbarment proceedings are typically started when a lawyer is accused of unethical behavior, and a formal committee is assigned to investigate the allegations and decide what to do about it. Today, the process for investigating grievances against attorneys is standardized, and it is conducted by standing bodies and established rules. Back then, a local bar association would form a committee when it was needed, and then both procedures and ethics rules were a little bit fuzzy, which made outcomes less predictable.
More importantly, ethics investigations are usually in response to some clear, specific behavior. A lawyer is accused of stealing client money, either intentionally or through mismanagement. Probably most commonly, lawyers face a threat to their license because of substance abuse or mental health issues or cognitive decline that results in gross ongoing dereliction of their professional duties. But regardless of whether they're guilty of what they're accused of, there is a clear trigger. Money disappears, for example, or they lose hearings or trials because they just quit showing up for things. Campbell's disbarment trial was different from ones that came before and was probably different from any disbarment proceeding that came any time after, because it did not start with a specific allegation. It started with a presumption that T.C. Campbell was unethical, and that if a committee investigated him hard enough, they would find something that justified disbarring him. The goal was not to determine whether or not Campbell had committed unethical behavior. The goal was to find something, anything, that justified taking his license to practice law.
In theory, the disbarment investigation was a response to the Berner verdict and the widespread rumors that at least one or more jurors had been bribed to reach their decision. But the inquiry into Campbell wasn't limited to the Berner trial. His enemies saw an opportunity to kick him out of the practice of law and destroy his political power in the process, and they were going to leave no stone unturned.
And this is where we get back to the rivalry that we mentioned a few times early in the season. In his personal letters during and immediately after the riot, Will Taft betrays his obsession with Campbell. He expresses a deep concern over whether the law library was insured. But with the exception of grieving John J. Desmond, Taft doesn't show much thought to the victims at all. He called T.C. Campbell the cause of the riot, and he believed that, quote, "the blood will not have been spilled and the property will not have been lost in vain," unquote, if the tragedy could be used to end T.C. Campbell's legal and political career. The Cincinnati Bar Association formed an investigating committee. The members would report both to the Bar Association and to a special grand jury that was being called to investigate the causes and culpability of the riot. In his role as investigator, Will Taft would travel from New York to Peoria, Illinois, and a lot of places in between, scouring the earth for faded memories or traces of evidence.
So, investigation for the disbarment proceedings and the Hamilton County Special Grand Jury tasked with investigating the riot more broadly began together. But the special grand jury would take the first shot at assessing blame.
But there were restrictions on the scope of the special grand jury's investigation. Although it was called solely for the purpose of looking into the courthouse riot, and it was composed of hand-picked, prominent citizens, it was still a grand jury, meaning that it was supposed to be investigating indictable crimes, as opposed to any broader social causes.
For example, local newspapers had helped inflame the public with irresponsible and inaccurate reporting in the lead-up to the Brunner trial and its aftermath. The Cincinnati Inquirer ran a large, front-page article titled "College of Murder" that was written to frighten and inflame the public and presented the perception that crimes like the Avondale murders or William Kirk's murder were becoming commonplace in Cincinnati due to the criminal justice system's failure to hang guilty murderers. This echoed the German-language paper, The Free Press, that wrote, quote, "The law of capital punishment has become a dead letter in Cincinnati. Among all criminals, the murderer is the safest in the expectation of immunity from punishment. Can it be a matter of surprise that the crime of murder is becoming more and more frequent?" End quote.
The Commercial Gazette reprinted Free Press disinformation in English, and it openly praised recent lynchings in other towns. In an article entitled "Increase of Brutal Crimes," the Commercial wrote that murder and rape were increasing dramatically in Cincinnati, and it claimed that this was the direct result of a weak and corrupt justice system. The Commercial published the conclusion that, quote, "The only real administration of justice in atrocious crimes is by Judge Lynch," unquote. Aside from the irresponsibility of walking right up to the line of telling Cincinnatians to form lynch mobs, the reporting was also factually inaccurate.
Arrests for assault with intent to kill, cutting with intent to kill, and rape were effectively unchanged for the past decade. Although it was undoubtedly very underreported, there were fewer than 4 arrests for rape annually over the preceding 5 years. Of the city's 8,094 arrests for all criminal offenses in 1883, roughly 40% of the crimes were drunkenness and disorderly conduct.
Murder arrests were up in 1883, but just barely. And arrests were an imperfect way to calculate the homicide rate anyway. No one was arrested in 3 killings in 1882, for example, because the crimes were unsolved, and 3 killers avoided prosecution that year in domestic murder suicides.
Ironically, some of the increase in murder arrests that drove the local media into hysterics could be attributed to better law enforcement. While the number of murder arrests reached a new high, the number of people charged with manslaughter fell slightly, as homicides that would have been considered manslaughter in previous administrations resulted in murder charges. Prosecutions were more vigorous, and even very modest civil service reforms had led to a better police force. Murder arrests were up in 1883 in part because, unlike in 1882, Cincinnati police had a 100% clearance rate on murder cases in 1883. 100%
is a hell of a clearance rate.
It is.
As an aside, this is one of the parts of the story that has parallels to our current moment. Both in Cincinnati and nationally, crime rates have been mostly declining or holding steady. Like other cities, Cincinnati saw a spike in homicides during the COVID years of 2020 and 2021, but then the number fell back down to the 70-73 average number of homicides that it typically has. But crime, nevertheless, was discussed a lot during the 2024 presidential election and during Cincinnati municipal elections in 2025. Today, like in 1884, there are real problems and some very, very tragic deaths. And there's also some genuinely broken aspects of the criminal justice system that we should fix. But the idea of a crime wave is a myth. It's a myth that is perpetuated today by the media to increase viewership and clicks. Back then, it was to increase newspaper sales.
But because it isn't a crime for media outlets to be irresponsible or for newspapers to operate on the "if it bleeds, it leads" principle, the special grand jury was prohibited from investigating how the newspapers exacerbated public hysteria.
Similarly, some of the speeches at the music hall meeting that turned into a lynch mob were highly inflammatory and highly irresponsible. But even the most culpable of the speakers stopped short of directly calling for imminent violence. So investigating the culpability of the wealthy and politically well-connected citizens who put all of the pieces in place for a mass lynch mob was also completely off the table. Formally, because there weren't any clear indictable offenses, but also probably because of who they were.
Of course, if the National Guard acted with a reckless disregard to human life, if they murdered people in the street at random in a way that far surpassed the necessary force, and if they shot to kill without ordering people to disperse first, so-called reading the riot act, which was an actual literal requirement under Ohio statutes before you could start shooting a crowd, and something that was not done on either Friday or Saturday night, those actions could be indictable offenses, even if it were only the commanders who were held accountable.
But one man took that possibility off the table. The presiding judge instructed the special grand jury as part of his instructions on what they were allowed to investigate that, quote, officers, civil or military, were in obedience to the law, unquote. He declared this to be a matter of law, even though it was not an accurate legal statement. So the people who were supposed to determine who was responsible for all the loss of life and property were specifically prohibited from considering whether anybody in the National Guard or Sheriff Hawkins held any liability, even if an objective interpretation of the law would have let them been indicted.
Which really limited their role and their usefulness. But the judge also wanted to help explain what they were supposed to do. He said that bribery was an obvious example of an indictable crime. So if there were allegations that an attorney, say T.C. Campbell, had even attempted to bribe a juror or potential juror in any way, giving a very broad definition of attempted bribery, then that person should be indicted. It wasn't even subtle. The judge was blatantly telling the jurors to indict T.C. Campbell for bribery, regardless of how thin or unsubstantiated the allegations were.
Murder, he explained, was also clearly an indictable crime. And someone had murdered Captain John J. Desmond. So they were supposed to investigate his death and indict the killer. Unless, of course, they came to the opinion that he was killed by friendly fire from his fellow National Guardsmen.
And arson was a crime, so they were also supposed to indict people, or somebody, for setting the courthouse on fire. In addition to the grand jury's instructions, the highly biased Prosecutor Pugh would oversee special grand jury deliberations, and although he did not have a formal role in the process, William Howard Taft was throwing his full energies into finding allegations against T.C. Campbell.
Hamstrung as it was, the men who served on the special grand jury took their role seriously. They met for 23 days and called 182 witnesses. Ultimately, they indicted 54 people. But only a fraction of these true bills would ever be shared with the public. Since grand jury proceedings are secret, the public only learned of the indictments that Prosecutor Pugh decided to act on. Over 30 different people were charged with inciting riot, for example. Some of them might have even been music hall meeting organizers, but we will never know. And only one man, a laborer and a family man named William Hart, was charged with arson for burning down the courthouse.
Four of the burner jurors were indicted for perjury-related offenses for things that they said during jury selection, although only one of them, A.F. Shaw, the jury foreman, would actually wind up going to trial.
And, of course, to absolutely nobody's surprise, T.C. Campbell was charged with bribery in the burner trial. Despite all the witnesses and all of the heavy-handed approach to suggesting that Campbell had bribed one or more of the burner jurors, Campbell's charge was not related to any of the charges against the four indicted burner jurors. The extensive, biased investigation failed to find a scintilla of evidence that Campbell had bribed any of the jurors who heard the case. The charge against him alleged that he had unsuccessfully tried to bribe a man named Michael Gabe, who was dismissed during jury selection and didn't serve any role in the burner trial.
Speaking to reporters anonymously, members of the special grand jury said that they wanted to extend their work for another 2 weeks, and that if they had been permitted to do so, they would have had sufficient evidence to indict some, quote, well-known persons, unquote, which probably explains why they were barred from further deliberations.
Nobody was indicted for murdering Captain John J. Desmond. There were a variety of stories and suspects, and witnesses were heard, but all of the allegations against various accused murderers were completely discredited.
Now, during all of this, Will Taft turned looking for dirt on T.C. Campbell into a full-time job. As he even conceded in private letters, it also became an obsession. When allegations and rumors were not supported by any corroborating evidence, Taft never conceded that they were untrue. Instead, he said that it was impossible to find witnesses against Campbell because, quote, the only witnesses of Campbell's rascalities are men who were as deeply implicated in them as he was, unquote. It was circular logic. When Taft couldn't substantiate claims, he saw the lack of evidence as further proof of guilt.
One of the claims that Taft helped mine led to both disbarment allegations and the one criminal indictment against Campbell. He was charged with attempting to bribe Michael Gabe in the burner trial. Now, Gabe had been one of Campbell's clients, and according to him, Gabe, when he became one of the people called as a prospective juror, Campbell had approached him and told him that he would forgive the balance of legal fees that Gabe owed him if Gabe would lie in jury selection and say that he didn't have any connection to Campbell. Say whatever else he needed to say to get seated on the jury. Then, after the trial, vote for acquittal during deliberations.
It was a very damning and seemingly straightforward allegation. If true, it confirmed that Campbell at least tried to bribe jurors in the Berner trial. This would validate the public's opinion of the jury and their verdict, and it would be sufficient to convict Campbell of a crime, albeit a misdemeanor. And more importantly, it would be sufficient to get him disbarred.
The first problem was that Gabe didn't actually serve on the Berner jury. Gabe was in a group of jurors who were all dismissed on a motion of the defense team based on a technical problem with how they were all summoned. Nobody could even remember if Gabe was questioned. So if Gabe even opened his mouth during jury selection, nobody remembered what he said. And he didn't play any role in the trial or the verdict. And the only proof that Gabe had was his own word. Although, why would he lie about this?
Gabe's allegations would be tested in two criminal trials and the disbarment trial. And in each subsequent trial, the answer to this became clearer. Gabe owned a bar, and in 1882, he accidentally shot and killed a man in it. He hired Campbell to defend him, and Campbell charged him $600. The gun had genuinely gone off by accident while Gabe was moving it for safekeeping, and Campbell got the charges completely dismissed before trial. It was a good result for Gabe, but he was furious that he paid Campbell so much money for seemingly doing so little work. So Campbell agreed to reduce his fee to $400, roughly between $10,000 and $11,000 today. And Gabe started making payments, but he also threw public fits about it and called Campbell a crook.
Campbell was furious over the way Gabe constantly mouthed off about him. And Campbell made collecting payments from Gabe a matter of principle. He started sending his office runner into Gabe's bar every week to remind him to make a payment. And he did it more to irritate him than to actually get the money. In return, Gabe told every bar customer who would listen to him that as soon as he got an opportunity, he was going to find a way to get even with Campbell. And multiple bar customers, including police officers, testified to this.
Everything came down to Gabe's credibility versus the credibility of the man that Campbell was with when he allegedly tried to bribe Gabe. Will Taft helped find character witnesses to attack Campbell's witnesses and to prop up Gabe, and it gave Gabe more credibility than he deserved. The first jury to hear the charges and decide who to believe deliberated for 15 hours over 2 days, and still ended in a hung jury. As a result, Campbell would have to defend the charges in a second criminal trial and in the disbarment trial.
We're about to get to the disbarment trial, but to skip to the chase on this particular allegation, Gabe found it increasingly difficult to keep his story straight or to hang on to whatever credibility he started with every single time he had to testify and retell his story. In my personal opinion, Gabe was a weasel and a liar. And the three-judge panel who heard the disbarment proceedings also did not find Gabe credible. And when Campbell was eventually retried criminally, he was quickly and easily acquitted. The only instance of Campbell bribing a juror that Taft could find to prosecute appeared to be a lie fabricated by a petty little man who was angry about his legal bill.
Which takes us to the rest of the disbarment proceedings. The Cincinnati Bar Association released 9 charges against Campbell, alleging 9 counts of unethical behavior dating back to shortly after he graduated from law school. One of the charges was that he had a, quote, general and notoriously bad reputation, unquote. Campbell objected to being tried for his reputation versus what he had or had not actually done. It was a valid point, and that count was dismissed. Privately, Taft was pleased. He thought that he had forced Campbell to concede in court that he had a bad reputation. Taft thought this meant that he had won without having to prove the charge. Taft was hearing that Campbell's practice was suffering, that he appeared to be depressed, and that he thought that simply forcing Campbell to defend himself on criminal and ethics charges was going to permanently destroy him both politically and professionally.
He thought Campbell was already doomed, and he was obviously happy about that. But he also genuinely believed that the role that he was playing was so righteous that he took some liberties about how he performed that role. Will Taft was still a young man, so he was not the lead prosecutor in the disbarment prosecution, although he was the bulldog behind the scenes. Working hard, gathering all the evidence that he could, and sometimes appearing both willfully ignorant and a bit unethical in how he did it.
The disbarment trial was delayed due to Campbell's criminal bribery trial. During the interlude in the trial, Will Taft used his free time to serve as the superintendent of elections in Hamilton County. Now, as superintendent, he was supposed to oversee the integrity of elections, which he did diligently, getting 1,500 Democratic votes barred for alleged fraud. Combined with the allies that he was making through publicly battling T.C. Campbell, the role was good for Taft's political career. He helped get several Republicans elected, including sending Benjamin Butterworth back to Congress. Purportedly wanting to help Taft for purely civic reasons, Butterworth put him in touch with a man named Delfindahl, who accused Campbell of helping him fabricate evidence in a trial 7 years earlier. This was count 6 in the disbarment case. If true, it should have gotten Campbell disbarred on its own. And the witness was being vouched for by a respected U.S. congressman. Of all the charges, this may be the one that Taft worked hardest to support, advocated for the most, and took most personally.
But there are problems with this allegation, too. The first problem was the physical evidence. According to Delfindahl, Campbell had helped he and another defendant named Pfeffer falsify a document in a federal liquor tax trial. But nobody had the document. There was no remaining evidence that it had ever existed or had been introduced in the trial. And the co-defendant, Pfeffer, said that Delfindahl was making up the entire story. Delfindahl was, of course, confessing to committing a crime himself. But Taft made sure that Delfindahl was granted immunity in exchange for his testimony. Campbell had never even represented Delfindahl. Delfindahl had been represented by Butterworth. And Butterworth vouched for Delfindahl's story by claiming that he knew about the fabricated evidence when he was representing Delfindahl at the trial, although he couldn't testify that the evidence was actually submitted at the trial because he had left the courtroom to avoid implicating himself. Now, if this was true, he still acted in such an egregiously unethical behavior, meaning Butterworth, that he, Butterworth, should have gotten sanctioned or disbarred himself. Although he wouldn't face any repercussions for making these allegations against Campbell and basing them on his own purported unethical behavior.
In addition to being unable to prove that the falsified document ever existed or that it was actually introduced at trial, and in addition to co-defendant Pfeffer saying that the entire story was fiction, there was also a problem with both Delfindahl and Butterworth's credibility. Roughly a year earlier, in a completely separate trial that didn't have anything to do with any of this, Campbell had cross-examined Delfindahl on the stand, and he forced Delfindahl to admit that he had previously committed at least 28 different acts of perjury. It was a public humiliation that Delfindahl never got over, and in addition to being a proven serial perjurer, he had a visceral hatred for Campbell after that.
And Campbell had a similar history with Butterworth. When Butterworth had been an Ohio state senator in the mid-1870s, Democrats had hired Campbell to investigate corruption allegations against Butterworth. The court barred Campbell from discussing the nature of those allegations, but he established that ever since then, he and Butterworth had been, in his words, bitter enemies. So, in the end of a lot of testimony and credibility witnesses, there was no physical evidence or transcripts to support the allegations, and what evidence remained in court records tended to discredit the allegations. One of the eyewitnesses said that it was all a lie, and of the two witnesses that became the entire case, both had a visceral hatred for Campbell. One had a history of committing perjury for money, and the other owed Will Taft a huge favor for just getting him elected.
In another count, the Bar Association accused Campbell of committing a conflict of interest while he was the police court prosecutor, when he was just 2 years out of law school in 1872. The job was part-time, so he also maintained a private practice, which was expected. But the allegation was that he billed a private client for getting him restitution in a criminal case, using his role as prosecutor to make the deal. In the intervening years, the business client and the police court judge that oversaw the case had both died, and the defendant and his wife, who had moved to Peoria, Illinois, were the most important living witnesses.
Charges were muddled and gray, and the former defendant and his wife came pretty close to exonerating Campbell when they were deposed in Peoria. And although his behavior is shrouded in some mystery, there were credible reasons to believe that Will Taft tried to tamper with evidence and stop the defendants from being deposed. In Peoria, Taft wrote in a private letter that the fight to disbar Campbell was so important that it was a fight, quote, which must be fought without gloves, unquote. However, if the stories about Taft trying to tamper with witnesses in Peoria were true, Taft was doing more than taking the gloves off. He was engaging in extremely unethical behavior to try to prove that Campbell had done something almost equally unethical back in 1872.
In his closing argument, Will Taft backhandedly complimented Campbell on his abilities, energy, and shrewdness, but said that, quote, the profession should be purged of a man whose success in this community threatens every institution of justice that is dear to us, unquote. He concluded by saying, quote, we deny nothing to Mr. Campbell except integrity.
When Campbell rose to give his closing statement, he told the three-judge panel what it had been like to live in his skin since the riot. He said that friends had begged him to leave town, to leave for his safety. He refused to do so, but the rhetoric of his enemies in the press had caused him to walk the streets in daily fear of assassination. He then got personal, saying, quote, "I may say that of all the men who have raised their hands against me in this case, there is but one as to whom I have felt no act of mine justified him in putting himself in hostility against me. And that one was Mr. Taft alone," unquote. Responding directly to Taft's words, he struck juxtaposition between himself and his career and young Taft's background of privilege, saying, quote, "I have no other power than that which comes from reasonably good health, which enables me to work 16 hours a day. I have no influential relatives. My father has been an invalid for 25 years. Mr. Taft has said that the realtors deny me only integrity. As well might an enemy say, I will not thrust my rapier through your eye. I will not cut off your arm. I will not wound your leg. I will not thrust you once through the heart. Integrity is to a man what chastity is to a woman. Deny that, you deny all. In this case, I ask no consideration for my family, none for myself. I ask only justice," unquote. Now, his ever-present sexism aside, it was an impassioned defense of himself, and it was one that cast him as an underdog, fighting for his career and his honor against a born rich and powerful enemy.
When the disbarment trial started, news coverage almost universally assumed that it would end with Campbell's disbarment and the decisive end to his career. But as the trial progressed, and one charge after the other appeared to fall apart or weaken, the tone of the press changed. Even the Cincinnati Inquirer seemed to abandon Campbell for a while. But by the close of the trial, it wrote, quote, "Rarely has any man been subjected to such searching ordeal as Campbell has gone through, and few, indeed, could come through so little tarnished as he appears to be at the close of this great trial." And it wasn't just the Inquirer. Campbell's local press detractors remained unmoved and continued to write that the outcome would determine whether or not corruption would be rooted out in the local justice system or it would be permitted to flourish. But throughout the rest of Ohio and the Midwest, Campbell was begrudgingly gaining converts.
Based on the nature of any of the counts in the disbarment complaint, the judges could have acquitted him, disbarred him, or given him lower sanctions. Regardless of what you thought of Campbell, popular opinion was that he would either be disbarred or completely acquitted on all charges. Instead, the judges found him guilty on one of the eight counts, and only partly guilty of that one. In the police court prosecution allegations that dated back to 1872, judges found that he was, quote, "guilty of misconduct in office, but not of conduct involving moral turpitude," unquote. They also noted that he had been very young and inexperienced at the time, and they felt that that justified leniency. In a second count, they acquitted him of what he was charged of, but said that testimony had proven that he had gone out drinking with two of the jurors in a saloon during the trial, which was not a formal ethics violation, but it looked really unprofessional. So for these cumulative sins, he was sentenced to pay the costs of the trial, and he was suspended from the practice of law for 10 days.
Nobody was happy with this outcome, including T.C. Campbell. As the decision was read, color drained from Campbell's face. Turning to one of his attorneys, he angrily whispered, quote, "This verdict will stand against me all my life," unquote. He was livid that he had not been completely vindicated, and he vowed to appeal. Publicly, Taft took the high ground on the verdict, but privately he called it, quote, "disastrous and disgraceful," unquote. Although he wasn't as despondent as might be expected, because he believed that simply by giving publicity to these allegations, quote, "Campbellism has received a blow from which it can never recover, and McLeanism is on the downgrade."
But part of the verdict enraged Taft. Although Taft was a prosecutor, not the accused, the court said that in the one charge that Campbell was guilty of, Taft had clearly, unethically, tried to suppress the witness testimony. They did not recommend sanctions, and there would be no repercussions. And the judges would quickly be pressured to apologize to Taft for reaching their conclusion. But the fact remained that the defense had proven that Taft's conduct had been unethically overzealous.
Overall, almost everybody, regardless of sides, thought that the verdict was a gutless compromise, and for Campbell's enemies, it was about to get worse. The day after the judgment was released, the parties appeared before the court for arguments about the appeal and when the sentence would be imposed. It was expected to be a purely procedural hearing, so it was sparsely attended, but Campbell's cheerful and chatty demeanor before the judges aroused suspicion. Then the lead judge opened the proceedings and explained that the judges themselves were experiencing, quote, "considerable misapprehension of the judgment," unquote. Over the previous 24 hours, they decided that the 10-day suspension from the practice of law was excessive, and they lifted it. Campbell's sentence was reduced to paying for the costs of the trial, and even that would eventually be whittled down.
The one man charged with arson for burning down the courthouse went on trial on July 11, 1884. The witnesses told laughably different stories about seeing him in the burning courthouse from the street, engaged in vandalism. Not even witnesses who seemed to be propped up claimed to have seen him set anything on fire, and their descriptions of him and his clothing were very different. More importantly, he, the defendant, had credible witnesses to prove that he was shooting pool in a bar when the fire started, and that his only role was to go watch it from the street with everybody else. So he was easily and quickly acquitted.
Which really only left Berner jury foreman Alfred Shaw, who was accused of committing perjury during jury selection, although the charge was pretty ridiculous. When asked whether he had previously formed a strong opinion of the innocence or guilt of Berner, a question asked of every prospective juror, Shaw said that he had not. However, witnesses claimed that several days before, he had strongly, vociferously said to people in a saloon that he thought Berner and Palmer were guilty as hell and that both of them should hang. It didn't matter to the prosecution that the opinion that he shared was opposite to how he voted in deliberations after listening to the evidence at trial, just that he had lied about having an opinion.
It was an incredibly thin reason to prosecute anybody, and Shaw had a comically perfect defense. He didn't actually deny the charges. He said that it was very possible that he had, in fact, said every word that the people in the bar claimed he had. But first, he had no idea that he was going to be in the jury pool at the time that he made the statements. And second, he was so pissed drunk that night that he was just spouting off about what was in the news. And he was, to this day in his trial, too drunk to remember saying any of it. Shaw seemed really credible and forthcoming, and he was quickly and easily acquitted. Three other burner jurors were also indicted, but after Shaw, those charges seemed clearly unwinnable, and they just went away.
So, if you're keeping score, the entire riot was blamed on T.C. Campbell corrupting the burner jury and the criminal justice system in general. Although neither a special grand jury nor the very extensive Bar Association investigation could find an ounce of proof of corruption in the burner trial. The charges that moved forward against one lone arsonist proved baseless, as did the allegation against the burner jurors, and even after scouring half the country and 14 years worth of T.C. Campbell's legal career, there was not a single, provable, serious offense. Although William Howard Taft was right about one thing. As a result of prosecuting Campbell for a trumped-up bribery charge twice and charging him with 9 counts of unethical behavior that were very serious and damning on their face, and as a result of the newspapers that hated Campbell refusing to admit that he was anything less than the root source of corrupting the entire justice system, the false narrative that he bribed a corrupt jury would never be cleared. In the years and decades and generations that followed, his unproven corruption would be considered a historical fact.
It is of equal importance that the special grand jury was explicitly prohibited from investigating the National Guard, or the role of the media, or the incompetence of Sheriff Hawkins or Governor Hoadley. And if they believed that they could have indicted some of the wealthy, powerful citizens that formed the music hall meeting and who drove a crowd of thousands into a violent mob, they were prevented from doing so. There was only one other investigation that could have led to real accountability for the March massacre. And that was the coroner's inquest. We had to pack a lot into this episode 8, so we decided that it was probably nice to give you a little bit of an intermission. And in part 2 of episode 8, we're going to start out with a little look ahead to the ramifications of what William Howard Taft did not learn from his time going to war with T.C. Campbell. And then we're going to tell you about the coroner's inquest. And the coroner's inquest is such an important and also infuriating part of this entire story that we've been telling you that we think it's necessary to let you take a little break, relax your brain for a minute. And this part of the story, if you're somewhere where it's safe to do so, I'd kind of recommend you get a nice stiff drink. Buckle up and get the full rest of the explanation for how the truth of what happened in March 28th through 30, 1884, was ultimately completely whitewashed. So we'll see you back here for part 2 of episode 8.